All right, Rhett Zhao, who are you?
My name's Martin Fowler.
Okay.
I'm chief scientist at Footworks, author and loudmouth on software development.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Neil Ford. My ThoughtWorks is foolish enough to let people pick their own titles, and my official title at ThoughtWorks is software architect and meme wrangler.
Meme wrangler? Excellent.
Wow. That is awesome.
That's what it says in my business card.
Howdy, I'm Jeffrey Snover. I'm a partner architect at Microsoft. I focus on managing technologies and in particular Windows PowerShell.
Excellent. So let's dig in there a little bit. Martin, you did a seminar on DSLs.
Yeah, I did it with Neil, my colleague.
So talk a little bit about DSLs.
Well, DSLs in this context were it stands for domain-specific language. And the idea of domain-specific languages are computer languages that are of a very limited scope, aimed at a very small aspect of a problem, as opposed to a general-purpose language, which you can use to write an entire computer system. And DSLs are quite common. Good examples of DSLs in common use today are regular expressions, CSS, SQL, and the things we kind of see and use and work with all the time, but we don't understand as well as we'd like to, I think, how best to use them well and how best to take the opportunity to make use of them.
Interesting. And now, Jeffrey, PowerShell is, you're saying, is sort of a DSL. I mean, it is a DSL, yes?
It supports DSL, would be the way I say it. By the way, I should say, I attended Martin and Neil's talks. They were awesome. If you ever have a chance to see these guys, run. Don't walk to your nearest opportunity.
Do you want your $5 now, or should we wait?
No, it was just awesome.
Cool.
Great. Yeah, so PowerShell is, I like to call it the, you know, kind of the stem cell for domain-specific languages, right? So Martin would call that the inner domain-specific language, but I view it a little bit differently. And that is, domain-specific languages are great and they're horrible. They're great because they're domain-specific languages. Mm-hmm. They're horrible because they're domain-specific languages. I remember once I got a resume from a guy. Digital had this great domain-specific language called Koala, and it's for text processing. And it had everything you want of a domain-specific language. Produced very high-quality code, very low error rates. People were very productive. Mm-hmm. I remember getting a resume one day, engineer, senior guy, 6 years of Koala experience. I said, well, that's unfortunate, right? And threw it away.
Huh.
Right? And so the problem there is that they can produce these, you know, little cul-de-sacs of expertise where people can really kind of screw their careers if they stay in those cul-de-sacs for too long or too often. So I've always liked the approach that said, no, the inner DSL, as Martin calls it, or a model that says, hey, you take advantage of a particular language, and then you have domain-specific vocabularies. Tickle is great about this. And then the way we do it in PowerShell is you have a language, and then you can configure it with domain-specific verbs, and then you can constrain it. Say, these verbs are available, but those verbs aren't. These portions of the language are available, these aren't. But all the time you use the same set of skills that can be broadly applicable. So when somebody sees your resume and sees, oh, you got 6 years of experience in it, they don't take your resume and throw it in the bin.
But if you replace the word DSL in those statements with the word framework,
I agree completely.
It completely applies across the board because it's really not that much different than a framework. It's really just a friendly way to consume a framework without having to always supply explicit context and all that sort of stuff. So the exact same poison for your career if, oh, I've been using, you know, Bob's persistence framework for 10 years. I'm an expert in that. Well, Bob's gone away. And so you're screwed now.
You know, it's true, but honestly, when people see the resume and they see, you know, 6 years of working with Bob's frameworks in C#, they'll say, Bob's framework, not so interesting. But, okay, well, he's a C# guy. You know, he passes the filter.
But this is part of the thing. You don't build systems in a DSL. You use multiple DSLs, usually together with one or more general-purpose language, in order to build systems.
Yeah, that's
so you're never really going to be an expert in, you know, one particular DSL and nothing else. Just like you can know a lot about Hibernate, but you're not going to only use Hibernate to build an application. You have to combine it with other stuff. And that's the crucial difference between a DSL and a general-purpose language. You always have to use multiple DSLs, usually in conjunction with one or more general-purpose languages, in order to get anything useful done.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that true, though?
Yes, like I think so.
AutoCAD's a domain-specific language.
Well, it's part of the definitional issue. Yeah. It's whether a domain's, whether you count full-power programming languages that are targeted towards a particular domain as a domain-specific language.
Right.
That was in the tutorial, I made the point that, if you bring it, if you allow that, the problem is then domain-specific languages can be anything.
Yep.
So I narrow my definition of domain-specific languages to be languages of limited expressiveness, in which case AutoCAD fails, because AutoCAD is a full-blown, well, it's a Lisp, full-blown Lisp.
Exactly.
So the area that interests me is these languages of limited expressiveness. I mean, you can't write a whole system in regular expressions or in CSS. I mean, but at the particular tasks that it's focused on, they do extremely well at doing that. And in fact, most domain-specific languages, and certainly most good domain-specific languages, are not Turing complete and have very limited or no ability to create new abstractions. While obviously full-blown programming languages have to have those two features.
Yeah, I agree. I think the idea of regular expressions is a perfect example of the model you proposed, and I agree completely. We have these like little languages to solve particular problems. You know, text parsing, regex. I mean, you can throw rocks at regexes, but as a DSL, it's a perfect example of something that solves that.
Very good for what it does.
And it's embedded in lots of different environments. .NET environment, Perl, PowerShell uses them. They show up everywhere.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the things that we're starting to learn about using DSLs is they're one of the danger signs of as you start building a DSL and it starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger and it accidentally becomes Turing complete and then it gets bigger and bigger. And before long, you know, it's now become self-aware and it's creating robots and are hunting people. You don't want to go there. That's a bad place to be.
Yeah.
But I think the way that you use this really effectively is by composing multiple DSLs, just like you compose multiple frameworks to solve problems. And in fact, if you look at some of the language workbench stuff, the guys like MPS, JetBrains metaprogramming system, the way that they are building a particular piece of software is they have 36 different DSLs that are really the guts of how everything works in the system. It's 36 different ones that are more or less orthogonal to one another, but do just one very narrowly defined thing at a time. And I think that's the key, is to keep it really super small. I think you err on the side of being too big way more than you err on the side of being too small.
For the actual language implementation.
For the DSL itself, yep.
Now, that sounds somewhat complicated for, you know, if another developer comes into this system with 36 DSLs, he'll have to learn.
But replace the word DSL with framework. Mm-hmm.
It's
that's
the same
exactly the place we are right now. Yeah. Exact same thing.
This is a very... With many things when you're talking about DSLs, you need to do this substitution of DSL with framework and then ask the question again.
Okay.
And you find that leads to a great insight. So again, this 36 different languages, but you've already got 36 different frameworks. What's the extra cognitive effort of understanding the frameworks without DSLs on top of them as opposed to the frameworks with DSLs on top of them? Well, the extra cognitive effort is small and may probably be negative, because the whole point of DSLs, of course, is to make frameworks easier to work with. So again, we have this, you know, I feel a blog post coming on about this. I've just got to get the right, you know, pithy, blicky name for it. But it's around this substitution idea.
But don't you think that works for a certain set of aspects, but then there are other aspects that doesn't quite get it, in my mind. And the whole notion of, like, tooling, right, or ecosystems. You know, whenever there's something out there, there's an ecosystem around it. And the question is, well, with a syntax, there's a rich ecosystem of things, right? Syntax-aware editors, source code control systems that know how to deal with these things, static analyzers, etc. Whereas with frameworks, I guess, I don't know, that they have the same sort of ecosystem that is different. You know, if I had two different... You know, I'm not sure what set of tools I'm going to lose by choosing a different ecosystem, but I do know a set of tools that I'll lose if I choose a different syntax.
Well, again, this depends on the kind of DSL you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about internal DSLs, which are effectively just particularly language-like idiomatic APIs, good examples are things like the JMOC framework uses that kind of thing. I'm trying to think off the hand. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the .NET space at the moment with people playing around with fluent interfaces and that kind of stuff. RhinoMox is a good example of that. all of this kind of stuff, I mean, you're using your regular programming language. You're just using it in this particular fluent style to make it easier to read and understand and say things. And as a result, you have the full power of your normal programming environment with you. I've got Visual Studio, and perhaps more importantly, I have Rig Sharper, so I can actually do the kinds of things I want to do. Sorry, this is a Microsoft broadcast, so I have to take every little dig at the evil empire I can.
Go for it. We are the Death Star.
And as a result, you have that power with you. Now, when it comes to external DSLs, which are entirely separate languages that you have to use a parser for and all the rest of it to pull in, then yes, the tools problem is a much more significant issue. I suspect it's the kind of issue that could be solvable once people put their mind to it. I remember in the early days when I was talking about refactoring, people saying, oh, this is impossible, ridiculous to do by hand, and you could never build tools that would support refactoring like this. It was always a bit of a weak argument because I could just point them to the Smalltalk one. But for a long time, that was the only tool available. People would say, well, you could never do refactoring tools like that in a static language like Java. And of course, now the refactoring tools in Java and C# have far outshone what you get in dynamic languages, and we're getting the reverse argument. Yeah. So I wonder whether actually, if people paid more attention to external DSLs, we'd actually see this kind of tooling appear in interesting and imaginative ways. Well, and of course, the language workbenches, they are entirely based around tools.
Well, and I think what people do is they have this mistaken notion. In fact, Martin has a really good leaky blog entry called One Language. This mistaken notion that there's one suitable language that can solve every problem. And you end up doing ridiculously complicated things. And Link is actually a good example of looking at the pain of doing that in .NET and building a DSL inside C# to solve that particular narrow problem domain and make it so much easier. A good example in the Java world is Swing. Swing is ridiculously difficult to build in Java code, but you can use DSLs written in either Groovy or Ruby. Both of them have really good DSLs to help you build Swing stuff. Rather than beating your head against a brick wall of trying to build that in Java, there are much better ways that fit on top of that ecosystem that lets you build that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing about the other element of the DSLs and a plus in the external DSL camp is this idea that you have an artifact, and who generates that artifact, and when I get one of those artifacts, what's it mean? Right? So in the case of an internal DSL, the artifact is Java, whatever code. Right. Well, what does it mean? And the answer is, well, it could do anything. So, boy, I've got to inspect every single line of that code because, you know, I got to know what its potential harm is. Unlimited. With an external DSL, there's kind of a formal contract. Here's the range of things that can be expressed by this language, and then you can say, oh, anything that's that content, I trust. You know, I just don't care because it only has this range of ramification. Or I only need to QA it or test it to this level.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at that is that an internal DSL is limited in expressiveness only by convention. And you can always throw bits of the general purpose language willy-nilly in amongst the DSL stuff anytime you like. So that can worry a lot of people because you can do anything the host language can do. If you want to actually just deliberately want limited capability because you want to limit the amount of testing you're doing or security issues or things of that kind, you've got no way to provide a kind of firewall-like barrier in place around the DSL. With an external DSL, of course, you can do that because the only things that you're going to allow are what your parser is going to take and manipulate, and there's no way of throwing anything else in there. Unless you put trapdoors into a language, which is often a useful technique for external DSLs, but obviously you'd want to limit it in that technique.
And so let's talk a little bit about Anders in his keynote today. He's talking about when he was doing, you know, the classic static versus dynamic argument. We did a lot of that at last year's JAL on Channel 9. We did a bunch of interviews covering that because it's an interesting debate. But throw that away and talk about static and dynamic, and where you have a language like C#, where you put in all these new features, functional, declarative, metaprogramming. What do you think about that? I mean, as a
well,
DSL guy.
Well, the first thing to bring out is a point that Neil is about to make, but I'm going to make it for him, which is his point that the static versus dynamic argument is boring and silly and is really irrelevant.
Okay.
What's really important is essence and ceremony. The problem with static languages, as we currently know them, is that they're just very repetitive. You're constantly having to repeat the type, repeat the type, repeat the type, repeat the type. And that really gets in the way. If you have languages that do type inference, And there's a limited amount of that at the moment in C#, but much more aggressively in languages like F#. You can actually get rid of a lot of the ceremony that currently is associated with static typing and get that nice cleanliness and lack of repetition that you get in a dynamic language, but at the same time get most of the advantages of static type checking. And that gives you a much more to... It's not entirely a best of both worlds route, but there are some things that dynamic languages allow you to do that you just cannot do with purely static languages. But what was nice about some of the stuff that Anders was talking about was some interesting ideas about allowing you to mix the two together in interesting ways, which I thought was really quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of direction, what we want to do is get rid of the ceremony, get rid of the unnecessary verbiage, and be able to focus more cleanly on the things that we really want to aim at. And I think it'll be a mix of languages that will get us there. I'm very suspicious about the one language covers everything. It's been, you know, the desire for a long time that we should only have this one language. And I just think you're just chasing an illusion with that. You need to express different things. So you're always going to have, you're going to need multiple frameworks and multiple languages to help drive those frameworks. And I think that's going to be the way to go.
Yeah,
polyglot programming, that's what Neil calls it.
Yeah, polyglot programming.
Polyglot programming.
Yep, okay. Which is this idea that we have these great managed runtimes now, Java and CLR, and we can start using languages that are more suited to particular problems. So, it's daunting to think about writing an entire application in F#. But why not just write, so you've got an application that's really seriously multi-threaded, like a scheduling algorithm or something like that. Just write that part in F# and write the GUI part in WinForms or something like that in VB, which is more loosely typed than C#, and easier to get that kind of stuff done. And, of course, you've got some C# business rules and that kind of stuff, but they all produce the same kind of code
Absolutely.
Underneath, and they can run on the exact same runtime. And I think that's where we're going to start doing, is using languages more suited to particular kinds of problems, but still run them on the same managed runtime. And back to the ceremony versus essence thing, last year I was calling this essential versus accidental complexity. And Stuart Holloway is actually the one who came up with the ceremony versus essence thing, and it's dead on. That, I think a lot of effort and noise has been invested in the whole static versus dynamic. And the thing that really brought it out to me was internal debates that we were having on mailing lists at ThoughtWorks from software developers, where all the dynamic language hippies would say, oh yeah, you know, dynamic languages rock and static languages suck. And then but somebody could come along and say, well, yeah, but that cool thing you're talking about, you can do that in Scholar F#. And it's like, oh yeah, you can. Well, you know, but beside that case, you know, but you finally realize that, well, no, really, it's not about the static versus dynamic. That's just one channel of information.
Sure.
And it really is more about, so every problem has some sort of essential complexity that you're trying to solve. And if you're using languages that build layers and layers of accidental complexity on top of that, before long, the problem you're trying to solve becomes obscured in all the stuff you have to do to get it solved. And so I think the more modern essential languages, which some of them are dynamic, some of them are more statically typed than our traditional languages, are trying to get closer to that essential complexity that you're trying to solve and reduce the friction around trying to solve those problems. And I actually think C# is going too far in the direction of trying to encapsulate everything on Earth. I think they should calm down on that and realize that you need F#, and you need C#, and you need VB, and you need languages that are really well suited to particular kinds of problems rather than try to build one giant one.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I don't know of any smart person that's still on the static versus dynamic discussion. I mean, it's just not interesting. Now, the conversation of when static versus when dynamic, that's a really interesting conversation, but that's where all the smart discussions happen. You know, I definitely like the idea of having multiple languages, but I got to say, I think it'll follow a salt curve. You know, add a little couple languages, makes your meal tasty, add a lot, tastes horrible. I once was involved at a project that Digital has brought in to kind of fix this up, and they came in, distributed systems management, had 18 different languages. I'm looking at this and saying, oh my God, they couldn't maintain it. They even had some Ada code. I said, well, how'd we end up with the Ada code? Did like somebody go to a night class and decide to put it in? And they said, yeah, that's how we got it. It's like, oh my God. So that was just a disaster. So, you know, well, what you say is true. There's also like, I don't know. I think it's good to have things that can be as expressive as they can be, You want to minimize things.
Well, but in the case you're talking about, it's much more difficult because anytime you're crossing language barriers, you get these impedance mismatches and headaches. But that's the beauty of having managed runtimes, because they all produce the same intermediate code eventually.
Yeah.
And so as long as you can build channels so they can communicate one another, as long as C-sharp can understand F-sharp data types with minimal headache, then it's not nearly as bad as the object-relational mismatch that we've been fighting now.
No, that's not the problem. It's the beer truck problem. When that developer gets hit by a beer truck or decides to join a band or his girlfriend wants to move to Alaska, then it's like, oh, God, what am I going to do with this ADA code? You know, shoot me
in
the head.
Well, again, though, we have to make the distinction, I think, between general purpose and domain-specific languages. I think I can't realistically see you wanting to use more than a couple of general-purpose languages. I mean, our colleague Ola Binney, I think, nicely characterized, saying you need something sort of very relatively static and fixed at the kind of lowest level. Then you build more stuff on top of that with a dynamic language. And so the combination of the dynamic and static stuff works quite well. But then additional languages that you would typically find are going to be domain-specific languages.
Yep.
And I think you will get 17-plus of those, just as you get 17-plus frameworks. The bus problem lies as it does the frameworks. You get it, replace DSL with framework, and you get that same problem. And it just means you have to, within your project team, make sure that there isn't only one person who knows about any particular framework that you're using. And that means good project practices. And then I would point you to the agile and extreme programming practices that we favor, with things like pair programming and things of that kind, that help spread knowledge around the team much more widely, so you don't get those critical areas known by only one person.
Yeah, we believe that specialization is for insects. We generally try to spread knowledge around the entire development team. There's not one person who just does database stuff, one person does just UI stuff.
Like
we pair program, and we insects specialize, but we want to be more generalist. Everybody on the team should be a generalist, so you cut way down on the truck number of your project. It would take a really bad, catastrophic truck accident or bus accident to put your project in deep trouble, and it also makes the work a lot more interesting. Yeah. If you get to do this today and this tomorrow, and you learn about the entire system, and you can have input in the entire system, and it's not just doing the same stuff day in and day out.
So one of the things, and I've asked Andrews this before, but I'd like to get your guys' perspective on it, is when do you create a domain-specific language versus just add a new classes to an already existing framework? I mean, I'm curious about that.
Well, a domain-specific language is an abstraction over the top of something else, and that's what you're really after, is a cleaner abstraction over something. So the way that that's done now, there's this distinction that Martin makes between framework code and configuration code.
Okay.
And everybody now is using XML for configuration stuff. You see XML everywhere.
Indeed.
And that's really an external configuration DSL that just happens to be easy to parse with really hideous syntax.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you can use internal DSLs to actually make that much more expressive and get better, better design time behavior, better runtime behavior, certainly much more readability. So it's really building a cleaner abstraction on top of things that are getting complicated. And that's one of the things that we talk about in the tutorial, is when things get complicated, we tend to try to build simpler abstraction layers on top of them. And that's the current thinking of a simplified abstraction layer is a well-crafted domain-specific language.
And another route, kind of like, I mean, that's one style, which is you've already got, or you're building a framework, and the framework is awkward to use, and you want to make it easier to use by layering a domain-specific language over it.
Mm-hmm.
Another route you can go is where you're talking to the business people about some intricate part of logic of their application, and you can actually try and build a domain-specific language by working with them, trying to capture their various rules in a way that you can see, that you can be able to take away and process. And that's kind of driving from the language. And there will be a framework there as well, because when you come to implement it, you will build the framework, you will build the language on top of it in just the same way as from the framework out. But here's where you're beginning to get to use the domain-specific language as a communication mechanism with the domain experts that you're working with. And potentially there's a huge gain there, because if you can use that to improve the communication channel, this is the critical area that breaks down software projects, is the communication channel between software developers and domain experts. Anything you can use to address that channel can have big, big impacts. And that, I think, is the most interesting area. It's quite hard to pull off, and it's not a huge amount of cases where it's been pulled off really well, but the potential, the payoff for having a success there is really great. So I think that's another important area to address.
I think of that in terms of the semantic gap. You know, I don't think, we used to talk about the semantic gap a lot, and I think we should talk about it more again. Right? It's this, the issue, when do you do a DSL? And the answer is when there's a large semantic gap. And that is to say, the gap between what I think and then the mechanisms I have to express my thought. And what you want to do is you want to have an environment where your expression is as close to your thought as possible. Right. So in the case of regular expressions, boy, through a set of libraries, boy, you know, it's like kicking a dead whale along the beach. Very complicated.
You don't think in regular expressions?
No, I meant without regular expressions. Okay. Regular expressions are hard, but they're pithy.
Yeah, they're pithy.
You can look
very
at them.
Very succinct.
Yeah. They are very succinct, whereas the equivalent code in library code would be just massive.
Yeah.
And whereas you think it's hard to read, understand what a regular expression is, imagine what that would look like as a set of API calls. It would just be horrendous. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, there's a great story. Your model of, like, you know, breaking down the barrier between programmers and users, I think that's spot on. The MySpace guys had this great, they're very early PowerShell adopters, and they had this wonderful story about how they brought in their operators, and they said, well, how do you want to run the system? They said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, just go up to the whiteboard and just write some things that you want to do. And they went up and they say, well, we'd like to get all the servers where this is down, and then we'd like to reset this, and then we'd like to do this. And they said, and they wrote a bunch of sentences, and they said, okay. And the operator said, what do you mean, okay? He said, well, that's what we'll do. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, here. And he goes, and he put dashes between the verbs and the nouns, and then cast things into a where clause. He says, that's what you'll be able to type. Can you handle that? And they said, yeah. And indeed, it was a great
That's exactly the thing, where it's a joint effort between the domain expert and the software developer. Well, the software developer's thinking, okay, what can I process, and what can be strict and make sense? And the business expert is thinking about, okay, what makes sense in their world? And that what they see is this kind of pidgin English. It's not quite real natural language, but that's okay because we're talking to a computer. We don't expect our language to be like talking to a human. But in that mix of the two and in that collaboration and communication is where the gold can happen. Now, where many people then shoot off on the wrong foot, I think, is they say, oh, we can get rid of programmers and only have domain experts write all these rules themselves. And, you know, that was the design goal behind COBOL, and I think most efforts that tried to take that attitude are doomed to the same fate. The COBOL inference, I think, rules over all of these efforts. I think it's very rarely you're going to be able to push the software developers out of the picture, and it's usually way too much effort to even attempt it. Where you want to be, the real sweet spot, is where you have the software developers and the domain experts together collaborating over the text of these DSL scripts. Usually the programmer's doing the actual writing of the code and getting it to work, because they're used to the whole test, debug, cycle, writing, decomposing problems, all the rest of it. That's what we are good at as software developers. And what the domain experts are doing are looking at what we've written and saying, no, that's wrong. That's not quite what I want. Maybe something kind of like this. And then the developer goes, oh, yes, okay, I have to make that work. But and then you're talking about something very concrete and very detailed. And if you can pull that off, and I'm not saying it's easy to pull that off, and I don't think we have enough practice yet, but if you can pull that off, you potentially can get a huge gain.
And so what about, you know, the specific problems that developers face? Say, like, you know, this concurrency revolution, that's the big thing now. Why not a domain-specific language for parallelism? Why build it into a library? It's a question for you. I'm just curious. I mean, developers need help, too, just like the customer you were talking about.
I think concurrency is too broad a thing to tackle with a domain-specific language. You want a very narrow problem domain. F-sharp is a good way to attack concurrency, but it's a general-purpose language. Just by saying, oh, concurrency, let's handle that. It's like saying persistence. Oh, let's handle that with the DSL, but that's way too broad. It's if you could narrow that down to concurrency for this very specific kind of case, and you can get it narrow enough, I think then you might think about an abstraction in a DSL, but this is not
parallel make.
Yeah, something like that. But it's not a silver bullet that, you know, oh, you can layer, you know, slather on a DSL and solve this really persistent hard problem we're facing.
Yeah, I mean, what's certainly happening is that people are looking at concurrency with linguistic approaches. I mean, I was just in Guy Steele's Fortress talk, and that's exactly about this, trying to make parallels and dealing with it in a more linguistic way. But those languages end up being general purpose languages because currency has a general purpose notion. So it's not really suitable for domain specific, limited expressiveness, domain specific areas.
Cool. It's domain with a lowercase d.
Well, the problem is that the term domain-specific language leads you into the trap of a literal interpretation of the expression as to what it means. That is, that it is a language for a specific domain.
Yes.
But the problem with is if you include that languages of full expressiveness, like a fortress or a PowerShell or the like, then in the end you have to include all languages and say, Java is a domain-specific language for the domain of programming the Java virtual machine. And you kind of go, it's a useless term. So that's why I narrow my usage of domain-specific language to be limited expressiveness, because then, we're talking about a different family of animals. And I wonder whether I should, use a term like mini-languages or little languages or stuff, which are also accepted terms of these things, instead of DSLs. But DSL has a lot of, most people kind of know what you mean when you're talking about that stuff, so I'm sticking with DSL for the moment.
And it's a three-letter acronym. Everybody loves three-letter acronyms.
Yeah. Exactly.
Of course. You got to love DSLs. Excellent. And now, Martin, you're writing a book on this, right?
Yep. I've been working on it for a couple of years or so, and it's still got at least a couple of years to go, I reckon. It's taken a long time to probe ahead on this, but it's very enjoyable. It's just slow going because there's the whole space and trying to organize it. This has to be done from scratch. So all the attention, there's a lot of attention on language theory and stuff and language community stuff in the software world, but it's all focused on general purpose languages. And no one really looks at DSLs because they're small, they're unimportant. But I like things that have been around a long time, are well understood in little pockets, but they're not widely understood. Because that's perfect for me to work on, because I don't get much competition. I can easily work on a book nobody else deems to be worthy of, and if it ends up being useful, it does well. That's what refactoring was all about. Most people considered it to be too trivial to be worth writing about.
So you thrive in environments of low expectations?
Absolutely. If you're going to want to be successful, you want to tilt everything you can in your favor. So head off in territory that nobody else is interested in and thinks is useful.
And you said that portions of the book are available on your website?
All the stuff of the book that I've done so far is available on my website. Go to my homepage, look for DSL Work in Progress, and basically once I complete a chapter and I've got it reasonably coherent, I post it. Usually when I post it, I haven't even run the spell checker over it. It's very raw stuff. And that's partly deliberate. I want to make it clear, this is work in progress. You're in the middle of a sausage machine. But I've got some good feedback from a number of people that have really contributed to some of the ideas and helped my thinking. So it's been worth it.
Yeah, the tutorial you gave was awesome. That was fantastic.
Great. Thanks.
Very cool. Well, hey, thank you guys for your time. Always fun to talk to people such as yourselves. So thank you for coming on Channel 9.
Yep.
Thank you.